the first episode of the Film Inquiry podcast. I'm your host, Alex Lyons, and today I'll be joined by two of our British writers who have joined me via Skype to discuss two very different types of comedies. The first, the black comedy indie hit of the year, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, and the mainstream blockbuster Amy Schumer starring hit Trainwreck. Our discussion today also leads to further talk of the modern indie director scene and how Hollywood has started to cherry pick any sort of successful indie director. And there's a lot of different film recommendations throughout, so be paying attention because we throw out a lot of titles that you really should be watching. Just a warning, there is spoilers for Me and Earl and the Dying Girl and Trainwreck. Thank you and please enjoy our first episode.
So pretty much Me and Earl and the Dying Girl is like this year's Napoleon Dynamite, Juno. It's the big indie favourite, the one that kind of came out of nowhere, and it's the one that everyone like, it's the best film, it's the greatest thing in art house cinema at the moment. It's kind of taken over from Slow West. Slow West was like the indie favourite at the start of the year, and now it's Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, and it's the one, you know, the top Rotten Tomatoes score and everything, except... And people really seem to love it.
Alistair, you should respond.
Well, I was just going to wait and cut in there. The reason I didn't like it, there's many reasons why I didn't like it. First, I felt that it was all about the main character. I mean, lots of people are talking about having this emotional connection to the film, and with the promotion for the film, lots of people talk about being a sort of tearjerker. But for me to cry at something, you have to have some sort of emotional connection to the characters. And the central character here, Greg, he's one of the most unlikable central characters I've seen in quite some time. He's self-centered, and across the arc of the film, he doesn't change his ways. Rather than he develops as a character, the other characters sort of develop to adapt to him. So it's not really a coming-of-age story for him, because he's the same asshole he was at the start, but everybody else sort of just changes to sort of fit his worldview. I mean, there's also the manic pixie dream girl trope, which I know many people think is sexist, but here is a valid point of how a female character, the dying girl, her character arc should be the main focus of the film, but instead, she is adapting. Whilst going through this terrible disease, she's still adapting to fit his worldview, which is sort of a very offensive rendering of that trope, if even her illness is playing second fiddle to helping him get into college.
Yeah, I think one of the big problems is that the film doesn't give enough time at the start to kind of give her a personality at all. So, like, he pretty much meets her. They have, like, one meeting, and she's, like, instantly, like, won over by him. And then, so pretty much once she gets cancer and, like, in the midway through the film, and they start fighting, and she gets all quiet, there's no real change in her character, because we really don't know what her character was like before that. So you can't be like, oh, this cancer has really struck in her, and it's really... This is such a huge shift in her personality. It must be taking a toll on her, because it's like no difference at all. Like, who cares?
It's quite shallow, I think. The characters aren't really like there. They're sort of like quirky versions of characters. I'm used to the Manic Pixie Dream Girl thing. I'm used to dying as a girl. I'm used to watching myself dying in films over and over again to inspire the man. But with that, I think, like as you said about him being loathsome, I think that's the whole point, is that he's supposed to be loathsome. So I didn't sort of hate him so much, because it's like we're supposed to hate him. But he's a bit shallow, and she's not really well developed, and the friend isn't really well developed. So I think I found it hard to sort of hate the thing, because I think it was supposed to be like it was just shallow overall. But I am sick of girls. I'm just sick of watching a film and being like, oh, I've got a female character to identify with, and like, oh, I died. Like, this is like spoilers, but like Sweet November, Walk to Remember, everything, it's like, oh, the girl comes along and she's really cool and she makes him love again, and then she dies, and it's like, it sucks. It's like there's like one film where the guy dies, and it's just, and even then he looks like really cool because he's like the one who struggled and he died to inspire her, and it kind of pisses me off in the end. But yeah, I just thought it was kind of like shallow overall. Like, I didn't sort of hate it, but I just thought it was a bit, and I get a bit sick of this like quirkiness in films, like, oh, we're gonna put some stop motion animation in, and like, oh my god, he's a teenager but he watches Bunuel and he knows who Werner Herzog is, and it's also, he's also kind of interesting and he has so many layers, and it's like, I get so sick of like all these American teenagers with all these beautiful bedrooms and they know who Bunuel is, and it's like, this doesn't happen. I want to meet the 17-year-old boy who, you know, can do Werner Herzog impressions. I mean, you guys can probably do Werner Herzog impressions.
Yeah, that's
the film sort of starts with a quirkiness checklist, doesn't it? Like, opening few seconds, stop motion, references to Pussy Riot, references to literature. It's like, right, we're just ticking off the boxes here. This is how you're going to win awards at Sundance.
Yeah, referencing the fact that you're a film with the whole how do you start this story. It starts exactly the same as The Spectacular Now.
But The Spectacular Now is very, very good.
Yeah, it's a better film. Because, I think the director, because I've got it up here, Alfonso Gomez Rejon, he really likes Werner Herzog. And he really wants you to know that.
This is like his love letter to Werner Herzog, like over and over again.
It's like the kid that like thinks he's an art student because he's bought a whole bunch of Criterion movies.
Oh yeah.
It's a beginner's guide to like art house cinema.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
I did like, that's what I think I liked about Greg, is that I've come across a lot of boys that, oh, like when I was in school, like the fact that I liked film was like, oh, people don't care if girls like film, but I'd have these boys come up to me and go, have you seen this like really obscure art house film? Because I've seen it and I understand it and I've had a lifetime of that. Like I'm 33 now and I get endless blokes going, have you seen like this Werner Herzog film? And you're like, yeah, I've seen it. And they're like, let me tell you about it anyway, because I think it's very important. But that's what pissed me off about Greg, and I just kind of thought, I think that's why I sort of liked him, because I was like, I've met you before. But it's a shame about, God, what was the name of the dying girl?
Exactly.
Exactly. What is it? Rachel. Yes, Rachel. Yeah. That's the point, isn't it? We don't remember her name. She's just got nothing. I suppose the whole point is, like, they say that after someone dies, you learn more about them. This kind of like, if he wasn't such a stuck-up prick, maybe you would have found that out while she was alive, but then maybe the point is that he is a stuck-up prick. I don't know.
I think it's an interesting...
I would have just given it...
Oh, sorry.
Huh? No, I was just finishing anyway.
I thought it was an interesting piece of casting using Thomas Mann as that main guy, because like, his claim to fame was being like the main dude in Project X.
Was he in Project X?
Yeah, like, that's how he got famous. And then through that, like, he always kind of plays these sort of douchey, you know, man, dude bro roles.
I think the most interesting thing about Project X is the fact that Miles Teller is in it, but his character is called Miles Teller.
Yeah.
And that is the sole interesting thing about Project X.
That is weird. I meant to watch it, actually, on Saturday night, because I found out Thingy's in it, who's in Pitch Perfect. It was probably, like, the own, like... He's one of the best things in Pitch Perfect. The guy who plays the boyfriend in Pitch Perfect. You guys seen Pitch Perfect?
Yeah, which boyfriend, though?
I've sadly seen both.
What do you call it? Anna Kendrick's boyfriend in it. And he's, like, super talented, and he's, like, in the other choir. And you're like, she's such a bitch to him. And he's, like, he's one of the best things of the film. But he's in, is it Project X?
Yeah.
Or is it 21 and Over? I get those two mixed up. They're just, like,
together. One's found footage, one isn't.
Both.
What's that?
Shit. Yeah, exactly.
I will watch. I just watch anything. I will, seriously. Like, I have a very small... Like, there's some westerns I won't watch. Or if somebody says, oh, this film, we watch it because it's based on kind of violence and there's, like, this terrible scene in it and that. And that, with ones like that, I'm like, oh, not so much. But I'll watch anything else.
What, something like Irreversible?
Irreversible. I have seen Irreversible, but I can't remember it, which shows how much of an impact it had on me.
Yeah. That's one of those films where it's always like, oh, that scene, you have to see it for that scene, and then, yeah.
But there's like three different versions of that scene.
Yeah, I know. when you watch the full thing, you're like, there's more to that than just the alleyway scene.
There are weird things. I had this thing in uni when The Ring came out, the original Ring, and everyone was going on about it. And someone did a presentation and decided to show that like key scene at the end, like the really scary one, as part of their presentation. And it's like, you know, spoiler alert. Spoiler alert had been invented then. But like, I've always been slightly mad at that bloke for showing me that scene.
The American one or the original?
The original.
Ooh, that's rough.
Because the Ring came out, and it was a really big deal, and we went to the Berlin Film Festival, and everyone saw Dark Water, and everyone who hadn't seen Dark Water was like, oh my god, Dark Water's so good. And then, like, the show, it's just, like, coming along to people who haven't seen The Sixth Sense, and going, I'm going to show you the end scene, it's the best part!
Yeah, I'm sick of girls dying in films.
One thing that I really...
Guys don't do much to the dying, it's kind of heroic.
Well, like, the thing is like, the point that they really, they're not even subtle about in the film, they just blatantly have John Bernthal say the theme of the film, is the whole, like, you know, you learn more about them after they die. But then the thing you learn about her after she dies is, like, I don't know, kind of irrelevant. It's just like the fact that she carves stuff into books, and that's supposed to be, like, a really interesting thing to justify the rest of the film.
The fact that you spent all that time carving things into books just made me think, well, surely you should be spending all this time with your family if, you know you're on your last days. Why are you just carving all this into books? I mean, come on.
I mean, this is really a very elaborate thing she's done over time with the squirrels or something. I don't know. It's a bit ridiculous because it's like, I don't know, like the fact that he gets away with it, I feel like Greg should have been punished somehow for being such a dick. It's like the fact that you turn up at the end doesn't bring all this behaviour.
I might be a bit, I don't know, like, but I didn't kind of get what the point of the final film was meant to be.
Well, in the book, this is what I've read, in the book she doesn't die whilst watching, spoiler, she doesn't die whilst watching it. In the book, she apparently stays alive and gives it a negative review. But the screenplay is written by the author of the book, so I'm not quite sure why he changed it.
Well, another interesting thing that's changed from the book is that at the end of the book, him and Earl aren't friends again, and Earl pretty much gives up film altogether. And it's kind of a more of a negative ending.
Maybe Jess went back on what he did. I find it quite weird as well that Greg is supposed to sort of... He doesn't really say about loving film, but he uses film as this sort of escape. But he has no interest in going to film school at all. And I'm just like, that's a bit weird. Like, if he's so... But then he doesn't... I don't know. It's really weird, his thing with film, because he doesn't seem to love it. It's just something he seems to do.
He puts a lot of work into something he kind of doesn't give a crap about.
Yeah, it's like he does see it as a job. I mean, that's why he refers to Earl as a co-worker. It's more like he sees this as a job rather than he just loves film and Werner Herzog and all that stuff.
Remember, Werner Herzog.
You know what it maybe is? It might be that Jesse Andrews isn't so much into film himself, and he kind of thought, oh, what would a teen... Like, he Googled, you know, like, what would a teenage boy pretend to love to impress... But then again, he doesn't pretend to love. He seems to honestly love Werner Herzog, but... It doesn't come across. I mean, they always say you should write about what you know, and Jesse Andrews doesn't seem to know a great deal about film, because it does come across as, like, really shallow. As people who kind of love film, we probably watched it and were like, yeah, we don't get this. That's not the way we treat it. But yeah, I didn't really feel much from it. I didn't hate it, but it's just, like, another tick on the slightly shallow approaches to girls dying of cancer. How many girls have to die of cancer before this ends?
Well, all I'm thinking of is Fault in Our Stars, where, again, spoiler, she doesn't die, but in the book it suggests that she might.
That's the thing. I didn't, because I didn't like Neustadter and Thingy's adaptation of The Fault in Our Stars. But I thought the Paper Towns one was really good, because I've read both books. But yeah, The Fault in Our Stars book is a lot more depressing. I mean, she's like moping around and reading books, But in the film, it's like, oh, she can't wait for the boy to text her. Because that's all we do. We all sit around waiting for the boys to text us, even when we're dying of cancer. Oh, it's just so, I don't even want, like, a guy to, you know, I don't want it to be like The Fault in Our Stars, but I was watching Love Story the other month, and it's just, like, all the women have to die all the time, and it's like, I don't get why this is a thing that has to be repeated over and over again.
It's
maybe because it seems harder.
It's kind of becoming a common trope, not even in these sort of coming-of-age stories and stuff, just action films and stuff in general. It's just kind of a sign of bad writing, where the writer doesn't really have faith that, you know, every redemption has to become, you know, being killed or being, you know,
someone die.
Yeah, it obviously it's like a common trope in, like, you know, the cops genre, but, you know, it's kind of becoming more of a thing now where, yeah, only can get redemption through a death. And it's something that you don't really have to do.
I think it would be more interesting if they had kept the original ending of the book and had sort of Earl not be friends with Greg and have Rachel just sort of criticise him before her death. Because then it would suggest that they're not developing to fit his worldview, which they do. They would have called him out on his assholeness and then left his life. It would have been a downer ending, but it would have sort of made up for the sort of the self-aggrandizing nature of his personality for the rest of the film.
Yeah,
that would have been good.
Yeah, no, because there's this, obviously it's in the book, because that's why it's in the film, but there's this really pointless kind of 15-minute chunk of the film about how him and Earl accidentally get high.
Yeah.
And I kind of don't get that they didn't really introduce or add to the plot in any way at all.
Yeah, I think it was one of those attempts at, again, to sort of, here's some humour, because this is a comedy drama.
Yeah, and it's pretty much the same as the high sequence in 21 Jump Street.
It kind of reminded me of Saved by the Bell or something, you know, just like this little bit, but from like a teenage sitcom.
Yeah.
It was strange how, really, I mean, with the drug sequence, you would expect some more, like, sort of cinematic, art-house visual references to happen. Because that would be a perfect excuse to bring them in, but nothing really happens. Just sort of get high for a bit.
Yeah, it's kind of the Seth MacFarlane way of writing, where it's more like, instead of subtly putting in your references, it would just be more like, here's Apocalypse Now, let's just name drop it so you know.
So this is essentially the Seth MacFarlane of arthouse movies.
Like, instead of having...
It's early here.
Instead of having faith that your audiences will understand who Werner Herzog is, you kind of have to set it up and name drop it and keep repeating it and actually show the original stuff.
I work at a cinema. And this week, me and Ill and Dying Girl has come out, and there's, like, been about 5 people in every screening. And one screening were just 2 people. It was, like, a mother and a, like, 10-year-old daughter who clearly loves Falling Our Stars. And I was just thinking, well, she's not going to get it.
No.
Like, who is this film for? Because it's being advertised as being for the Falling Our Stars crowd. But, like, who is it for? Because...
Yeah,
arthouse people are going to call it out on its bullshit.
Yeah,
I think teenage girls won't get it. I mean, the stereotypical teenage girl. Obviously, some teenage girls will get it. Don't accuse me of stereotyping, please. I don't know if it's going to be for the hipster crowd because, I mean, it's too mainstream for them. I assume. I mean, who is this film for?
It's for festival people, really. That's what it just seems to be for. Like, they go, ooh. I think it's kind of got that Toy Story 3 thing where, because the end, like, 15 minutes is so, like, overtly sad and so, like, kind of manipulative into being, like, feel sad, that as soon as you walk out, you still kind of carry that feeling with you of, like, ooh, that was really sad, that really did affect me. And I think it gets better reviews than it deserves because people are kind of writing them out of pure feeling, rather than kind of sitting back and examining the film as a whole.
Yeah, as I said, I have trouble emotionally connecting to the final 15 minutes of the film if all the minutes prior to that aren't doing anything.
It's literally 15 minutes of him crying for the end of the film while looking around at stuff.
Mm.
And because I hate him, I don't care. I hate that character so much.
It was a bit silly, that random, like, oh, look, she's carved something into your college handbook.
Yeah.
And it's a bit ridiculous. Anyway, there was only two other people in the screening I went to. And it's just kind of like, didn't they win, like, the Sundance Audience Award? And
yeah.
It just seems a bit, I don't know, superfluous. It's like, and then it's a shame. And then there's other films this year, like, you know, guys were talking about Mad Max on the Slack thing. It's like, nobody thought Mad Max was going to be up to much, because it's like another film in another franchise. And then Mad Max was awesome. I know it's a completely different sort of genre from this, but it's annoyed. It's a lot of people picking what they think they're supposed to understand. Like, oh, I understood Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, because it's like tragic, and it's young adult fiction, and they talk about Werner Herzog.
Yeah.
And it's like lots of people have chosen. Like, Little White Lies made it their film of the month.
Oh, really?
And I can't remember what else has been out this month. What else have I seen this month? I saw No Escape, and I think I probably enjoyed that more than Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, because it just had a sort of point to it. That's the thing, as long as you've got a point,
yeah.
Everything else is great.
Because this whole thing was like, I think the problem with the script that I really didn't like is that it constantly thinks it's one step ahead of the audience, but it's like not at all. And the
because it's that thing right at the start. Where she's in the corridor saying, oh, you've got the test results, and he walks back like, test results, I've been there. Like, pretty much clicking his fingers as he walks past.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this is a wise quip, and then it cuts back like 5 minutes later, and it's like, oh, it's Rachel, and the test results are cancer results, and things like that. Like, oh, isn't this smart how we've just shown this from a different angle?
The worst one is the recurring thing of, oh, you know, she doesn't die at the end.
Oh yeah,
but the
that's
opening
really
of the film, the opening of the film tells you that she dies anyway. So I kind of didn't get why it was trying to lie to the audience when it already told him the truth, because the film opens with that quirky punchline that was in the trailer, and they repeat it at the end of the film of the last person that saw one of my films literally died. So obviously the audience can put two and two together of, okay, she dies at the end. So when he goes, oh no, she doesn't die at the end, I was kind of thinking, are they trying to, like, trying to be smarter than the audience?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think the audience has worked it out from the title alone.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, that the point isn't that she dies at the end. We want to see that journey of what happens before she dies. It's not the point. And the film's kind of thinking the point is, oh no, she dies, and that's a spoiler for some reason.
I hate when they're using films. There's a great line in the beginning of... Have you guys seen Grave of the Fireflies? Because I don't want to ruin it.
I have seen Grave of the Fireflies,
yeah.
Got the Blu-ray and everything.
At the beginning, he said... Is it? Yeah, he says, you know, this is the story about how I died or something like that. And it's so profound and punchy, and it's such a brilliant film. Then other films and other TV programs have used that, like, this is the day I died. But it's always something like, their heart has just stopped, and they've been brought back, and all this kind of bullshit. And I think it's so annoying when it's just used in such a profound way in Grave of the Fireflies, and then other films are just like, oh, have I died, have I not? And it pisses me off so much. They did it in Doctor Who as well. And it's just like, this is the day I died. And it's like, it's not really, it's not the day you died. Don't try to amp it up like this is some huge friggin' drama.
Obviously, the one that nailed it, and that's kind of why everyone copies it, is Sunset Boulevard.
Oh,
that's where it all comes from. Out. And then you get
And again, talking of Sunset Boulevard, this is completely irrelevant. But Legend, Helsa has an example of the Sunset Boulevard narrating from beyond the grave trope. So
which one, the Tom Hardy one?
It's because what I love about Sunset Boulevard is the idea that you can show how it ends, but then be a strong enough movie that everyone's still like, well, how did this happen? Because there's some films that do that. I was watching Oculus the other day, the Karen Gillan horror, and they give away so much in the first couple of minutes.
Yeah.
You're like, there's nowhere to build up any tension from here. It's so annoying. I turned it off after 20 minutes, which I don't usually do, but it had it coming, seriously.
Yeah, that film really feels pointless by the, like, I watched it. It's a really what was the point of that sort of film? Like, when you get to the end, you're like, why did I watch that? Like,
I'm so glad I gave
that. Sort of enjoyably throwaway. Like, I mean, I don't need to watch it again, but it was fine, really. It's not really a film. It was a film that I had a hard time bothering to criticise. It was like, yeah, fine.
Yeah, this was like, moving on.
I can't remember when I turned it off to watch and I replaced it with something else. I watched a big pile of films the other week and I turned up, there was something I turned off and I ended up watching Roadhouse instead. And Roadhouse was so good that I've actually forgotten the film I turned it off for. I mean, it's so good. It's just so good. I can't believe it's taken me so long to see it. But yeah, I can't remember the film that I turned off. It's like, well, clearly didn't matter.
I think you get to that stage after you watch a couple of hundred films. They do really do become forgettable.
Yeah. I always say that when people ask me about certain films. Like, there's a couple of films, and I didn't realise I've already seen them. I've started getting films, and then putting them on, and thinking, this looks really familiar. Like, Hilary Swank and Sam Rockwell film about, he gets sent to jail, and she becomes a lawyer to free him. I can't remember the name of the film. And I put it on one time on, like, Netflix, and I was like, this looks really familiar. And it's because I've seen it before.
Oh, wow.
And it just had so little impact. What's it called? I can't remember. It probably isn't important.
I keep thinking I keep thinking of Dead Man Walking, which is the Sean Penn one.
That's really good.
And the only thing I remember about that film is that Jack Black's in it for like 2 minutes.
Is he?
Yeah, it's like his kid or something. I don't know. Who cares?
I think I watched that when I was like really young and it kind of traumatized me a little bit. Maybe that's why I think it's good looking, because it had that traumatizing effect. But, there's a lot of films like that, isn't it? It's always about people on death row. It's always going to be someone dies. Like, the really important films. It's like the way Oscar films always have to be. Somebody dies, or somebody's ill, or somebody's suffering.
Oh, it's a story of somebody's life.
Yeah. It's just, so I'm getting distracted by things now. Do we want to chat about Trainwreck? Because I'm kind of intrigued to chat about Trainwreck. Or because that's just come out recently. You guys have any views?
I just...
You guys start.
Yeah, I just... Judd Apatow is like one of those guys I like. He's a better producer than he is a director.
Yeah.
All of his produced films are quite a lot funnier. Because obviously the directors that he picks are kind of a lot more attuned to comedic timing and actually focusing on story. Because all of a Patel's films are way too long. They're always 2 hours plus, and they always kind of lose what their point is about midway through. And it's they're like overly stuffed with celebrity cameos and this weird focus on marriage or pregnancy being this the ultimate goal in life, and anything outside of that is like for kids. You can see it in 40-Year-Old Virgin, even to like Trainwreck. In Trainwreck, the message is, if you don't get married and have a start a family, you'll be a lonely old racist man who dies alone. And so it's just like, yeah, like, can you just kind of keep your politics, just subdue them a bit, because like...
Well, what I would say about being a lonely old racist man who dies alone is, though, because Amy Schumer gives that speech at his funeral, like, yes, he was racist, yes, he was homophobic, but put your hands up if you loved him, and, like, everybody raises their hand, so he doesn't die alone, because he's still in everybody's affections, really.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
He is still I don't know, but it was, I had a hard time getting my head around that film, because it was almost like, in the end, I just thought it was what happens when Amy Schumer didn't know what she wanted the film to be. And then Judd Apatow had this idea of what the film was supposed to be. And it all just sort of, like, crashed together like a massive train wreck. But she, like, it was like she was going, right, this is going to be kind of the kind of humour I write. There's going to be all these inappropriate jokes and this girl, and she didn't care what happens. And then it's about 40 minutes in, and it's just suddenly like, no, it's not okay. Suddenly her casual drinking isn't casual drinking. She's an alcoholic. And she doesn't just dabble with drunks once in a while. She has a serious drug and alcoholism problem. And we have to deal with this. And it's like, seriously, this film's just going to switch into this now? And I thought, oh, okay then, but the problem is all the way through it, you've got Judd Apatow's kind of like, why is John Cena her boyfriend? She's just like, and it's really weird because it's like, is she promiscuous or does she cheat on people or what kind of woman is she? And but John Cena is just weird in it and the character's weird and, oh, it was all so much of a head fuck.
Yeah.
Well, what I can say about that is that Amy Schumer apparently dated a wrestler in real life for a bit because it was in one of her stand-up things. So I can, yeah. That's why that'd be in there. That'll be why the John Cena stuff's in there. But as for the cameos, they probably weren't in her screenplay. Like, Judd Apatow was like, right, I've got these famous people on the phone. Do you want them in?
That's
got, you know, this film's only 90 minutes long at the minute. We need to get it over 2 hours.
Yeah.
So, come
on. Let's have a pointless scene with Matthew Broderick in it.
Why the hell is Matthew Broderick there? That is really weird. Because I can understand, like, no, I can't really understand the other sports cameos, but Chris Evert, at least, is like a sports person. But, like, Matthew, like, why the hell? And Matthew Broderick was mean to me at a film festival, so I'm, like, so pissed off at him. I can't watch Ferris Bueller's Day Off anymore. So I was just really horrified to see him in the film. But it was like that. It was like, Amy Schumer has this idea that turns into something else, but Judd Apatow is going to come in and kind of exaggerate it to these proportions where it's like, a woman is just doing what she's doing, but no, like, you can't, I understand this idea of someone going at the beginning, oh, someone's just a casual drinker, oh no, they're really an alcoholic, but that's not what they did. They were like, oh, look, she's having fun and that, but no, she has serious problems and her mother died and her father's died and she's really messed up and now she has to show Bill Hader that she's, like, awesome. Oh, yeah, it made me a bit mad.
I think this may just be speaking as an English viewer, but I've noticed the drug problems. The alcoholism just didn't faze me at all. It was like, yeah, that's just how people drink.
Yeah, so a few weeks. It's like they decided. They thought, oh, we won't do it on screen. We'll just decide. We'll put in the word there. It's like he comes and he's like, you have a drinking problem. And it's like, seriously, like the thing he was mad about was that she was worried about her job. He was doing the big speech, but she panicked. She went and took the call. That was the problem. And then suddenly they're like, oh, you're an alcoholic. And you're like, really? And they spend so much time talking about sports medicine in that film. You miss that entire 6-week section where they're like falling in love. It's like it was a romantic comedy up until this point. I don't want this to be a romantic comedy anymore. I want this to be a drama about an alcoholic woman who sleeps around and fixes herself with a man she loves. In other words, it's a Judd Apatow film. Amy Schumer, Judd Apatow. Judd Apatow went all the way.
I thought that whole speech thing was really, really contrived. It was just like, all right, we're at the 50-minute mark or whatever, and they need a reason to fight. And then
on the speech,
so she has to walk out of the speech. It just happens to be at the same time.
It's. A lot of it. It's a certain point. There's like a knocking off the cliff. It's about there, actually. It's probably just before the speech. Or maybe it's like when because her dad dies. Is it before or after the speech? And it's just like there's a point and the film just kind of falls flat. And it's like, Judd Apatow has this idea that the women around the men in his films are always annoying. And they have to be like less annoying. Like there's a bit in, is it Knocked Up? And Leslie Mann finds out that Paul Rudd is at, like, the fantasy football thing.
Yeah, that's a
knock-up. And he never gets his penance for it or anything. She's just kind of annoying, and she's like, I want to do step two, and I want to go to a club. I don't know how Leslie Mann puts up with this shit from Judd Apatow, because she's married to him. And then she's in his films repetitively as the whiny housewife. Oh, it just makes me want to punch someone. I still want to punch Catherine Hagel in Knocked Up. Just like, why can't you all just shut up and relax? Sorry, I'm getting quite hyper now. You guys should talk.
What I would say about Trainwreck is that I think I probably enjoyed it more than you two. I agree it's too long. I agree that the aspirations to sort of social realist drama are just problematic. But when it's funny, it is very funny at a rate that's, you know, probably one of the best of the year in terms of the laugh rate, I would say.
I'm trying to think of all the jokes I laughed at.
Well, it's been quite a week here in comedy so far.
Yeah, the only, like, comedy I've seen this year that I found funny is Spy.
Oh yeah, Spy was good.
I haven't seen it.
I did the review of The Spy. The Spy was something I sort of laughed at and then sort of left. I've been watching a lot of Horrible Histories recently, so like that's the funniest thing to me now is like Horrible Histories. I can't think of anything else funny I've watched this year. God,
I can't think of any Billy's comedies that have made me laugh.
No, I just legitimately can't think of any like big budget comedies that weren't, well, that wasn't Spy or Trainwreck this year.
Well, I probably laughed the most at the funny bit in Inside Out.
Yeah.
Realistically.
Yeah.
Like, there was Get Hard, which was Will Ferrell's one, but, like, who cares about that?
Oh, yeah, that was just, like, what's the point of that? Will Ferrell, you're better than this.
Yeah, that was just cashing in on Kevin Hart.
Yeah.
Apart from that, I can't
remember. Kevin Hart's not really a thing in the UK yet. Like, we've heard of him, but he's not.
They did that thing, it's the Wedding Ringer as well, which just looked like, it was like, I don't understand why that's even in the cinema. How has it not gone straight to DVD? Oh, Catherine Hagel's done another romantic comedy that went, it was supposed to go to the cinema, and like a month later it was straight to DVD, and it's ridiculous. She's like a housewife who kills people so her husband can get a job or something. And it's just ridiculous. Catherine Hagel, what's wrong with you? Stop taking these films. But then again, maybe she's only as good as these romantic comedies. They're not romantic comedies, they're terrible films. Oh, I never watched Grey's Anatomy, apparently she was brilliant in it. I don't know. Do you ever see Grey's Anatomy?
Negative.
Nope.
Oh, yeah, apparently she was great in that.
What's what people say about Jai Courtney as well? Like, everyone goes, Jai Courtney sucks, and their defense is always, oh no, but he was good in Spartacus.
He's in Spartacus. I always hate Jai Courtney. I really liked him in the new Terminator film. Wow. Strangely.
Yeah, I had no problem with him in that. It was just like, he's usually sort of bland, but in here he was just sort of better than bland.
Yeah, it was like, it was an improvement.
Watchable paint. It's like watching paint dry, if paint dry was slightly more fun than watching paint dry.
if it was a really good colour of paint, maybe, that was the thing.
Yeah.
I really like the new Terminator film, because I love the Terminator films, and it was just like a little love letter to like, we're not going to try and over-egg this. We're just going to take a bit of this and a bit of that. And, of course, there's some kind of confusing backstory into it. But I quite liked him. But I think I had such low expectations of Jai Courtney and the idea of another remake. I was probably, like, overly impressed.
I didn't say it, so.
A lot, recently.
Oh, everybody's breaking up again. What am I thinking that I saw this year, comedy-wise? I think I laughed probably a bit at Kingsman, but that's probably about it.
Kingsman's everything my else. Favourite film of the year still so far.
Kingsman is still pretty good. I've fallen a bit in love with Taron Egerton. I'm writing a feature on him this week after I see Legend. He's only made like 3 or 4 films, but I'm a bit in love with him already. But what was I thinking of? Something to do with Matthew Vaughn. I'm not sure how much I like Matthew Vaughn's film, sort of. But Matthew Vaughn's got that kind of thing that Brad Bird has got, and Judd Apatow as well, a bit, this idea of, like, pulling films, like, he has to stretch films out, so the structure is really good, but it seems to go on for longer than it should. I don't know.
What is it, Brad Bird really had that? Because the structure of his films, well, up to Tomorrowland, which isn't good at all, they're actually quite tightly structured. Like, The Incredibles and Ratatouille are very well-structured, I would say.
Well, that's, I mean, the structure's really good, but it almost seems like it goes on, like, to me, it seems like it should be like a song where the beat goes up and up and up to like a crescendo, whereas his is just like one line. So nobody could see this on the podcast. I'm just holding my arms, just one line, like a ruler. It just kind of goes like that. It's like, this happens. So it's a good story, but I don't feel any kind of impetus to get excited, and I don't build up to anything. It's just like, this. Oh, well, that's interesting. Because that's what Tomorrowland was like. It was like, this happens, and it's all quite interesting, but I didn't get anything out of him.
Tomorrowland is a whole lot of people explaining things you don't care about.
But yes.
For 2 hours. Yeah.
It's about the moral! It's about the moral, save the world! Oh, it's really annoying. You can always tell when a film's going to be pants when they just do so much publicity for it. It's like, you guys are worried. You're really worried about this film. Yeah, I like Brad Bird. I just don't. He doesn't spark enough for me, if that's the right word for it.
I haven't
actually Matthew
seen
Vaughn,
it.
I would say his better films, like Kick-Ass, that builds up tension very well because it's got a sort of climactic action set pieces. So that, I would say, is a good example of sort of structure and also building up the structure.
Can I just say how big of a disappointment Kick-Ass 2 was?
Oh, I haven't seen it yet. I was thinking it would be a disappointment, that's why I didn't see it.
It is a disappointment.
It's
there's a weird bit. I'll let you finish. Sorry, I'm just talking.
No, that's all right. That's all I was going to say about it. That's all it deserves, that it's crap.
No, there's a weird bit in Kick-Ass 2, and I'm not sure if it was like present in international versions of the film. Alex, you might be able to tell me, but...
Yeah.
In Kick-Ass 2, there's this weird bit, and a hit girl, she's at one of her friends' house, well, not friends, like these sort of, I don't know, sort of cliquey American high school girls. She's at one of their houses because she's trying to befriend them and be popular. And for some reason, they start going into a conversation about the boy band Union J.
Yeah.
And it then cuts to a full screen video of Union J's music video.
Yeah.
With, on the bottom of the screen, Union J. No, it's stuff like hashtag Union J, download at iTunes. And it goes on for about 15 seconds, just full screen,
yeah.
Just the Union J video telling us to download. Is that in the Australian version as well?
It was worldwide, yeah. It was just really weird shoehorning of this actual band.
Weird.
Yeah.
Like, if they went out of their way to...
Union J, that's sort of the cachet outside of the UK.
Yeah.
Barely known here.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they didn't really amount to much. But, like, if it was a fake band, you'd be like, okay, I get it. But, yeah, especially for a film like Kick-Ass, which is meant to be a parody, and then include real-life elements like that.
And that is strange for the fact that it's a band aimed at 12-year-old girls in a film aimed at, like, teenage male 15-year-olds.
Yeah, with this, like, ultra-violence in it.
Yeah.
And film then, is weird. Like, Pitch Perfect 2 had all these, whatchamacallit, through all this product placement, there's a bit, and the girls are at this, is it Mercedes or BMW kind of car event, and the German,
I for some reason seem to recall it being BMW, but I may be wrong.
Yeah,
I might be getting confused with Jurassic World, because there's a ridiculous car advert in the middle of Jurassic World as well.
It was Volkswagen, because I had to check. I think it was Volkswagen. And they're there, and it's like this kind of Kraftwerk rip-off, this big German stereotype. And like Volkswagen. And the girls, I actually got a picture online, and there's the girls, they've got like a Volkswagen advertisement behind their heads. And they've got this water in front of them that apparently is like $10 a bottle, like the superior mineral water. And then there's another scene where they've got like this big Pantene advertisement behind them. And it's just so annoying, because it's like, there's some advertisements in films, and they're so subtle, you're like, wow, that was really well done, because the person looked at their phone, they happened to have that phone. But it's when they freeze on it for a while, like they did it in the TV show Scandal, they gave them all, like, I think they were, I can't remember what kind of Android phone it was, and they keep freezing on their phones, like, look, Windows 7 on your phone. And it's just like, oh, there's got to be a style to this, and how come some films could do it better than others?
I haven't seen sort of good product placement outside of TV, wherein shows like 30 Rock or Community to like make a big joke out of it, and maybe even make entire episodes out of product placement and how bizarre it is. But in films, it's always like they're trying to be knowing about it, but they fail. Like in Kingsman, there's that scene where Colin Firth goes to dinner at Samuel L. Jackson's house, and it's McDonald's, and at the end he goes, "Well, thank you for that happy meal." And it's pretty much winking at the audience.
It's that's another thing I wanted to talk about, because this has really been bugging me, is Colin Trevorrow doing like Jurassic World, because I've seen Safety Not Guaranteed, that's like his only film of kind of note, and they gave him the Jurassic World film, and it's like, it's very strange. Like, why would you give such a big franchise to someone who hadn't really done anything? It's really weird.
Going back to Meal and Earl and the Dying Girl, one of the things I felt after I left was, right, the director of this is definitely doing a blockbuster that's costing $200 million next. That is my main thought. It's just one of those films. Low-budget indie movie, gets a lot of Sundance cred. Yep. He's going to be directing, like, Star Wars next or something.
It'll be interesting.
I didn't check.
I don't know if they had anything lined up at the moment, but it'll be interesting to see what... I had to leave for a sec. Which director were you talking about?
I've gone back to, well, there's Colin Trevorrow and Alfonso Gomez. How do you pronounce his name?
Rizon?
Because he's an interesting one because he's like, he started off as like an assistant to guys like Scorsese and stuff.
Right, okay, that's.
Alfonso Gomez, so Rejon.
His love of film may be sincere, whereas sort of Greg's isn't. Right. I can buy that.
Yeah, and then he became in the Ryan Murphy mafia. So he's done like a whole crap load of like the American Horror Story and Glee episodes. And then his first movie was the remake of The Town That Dreaded Sundown, which was produced by Ryan Murphy.
Ryan Murphy's just not.
And then this is his second film, which is like completely different to his first.
You see, that's the thing. If he made Glee and he did American Horror Story, no wonder. What did he have to do with Argo? Sorry, I see something here. There's something about him having something to do with Argo. He was second unit director on Argo.
Yeah.
And American Horror Story. Eat, Pray, Love. Julie and Julia. Bewitched. Oh. we should have
known that before. We should have been collaboration with Scorsese. He's left a pretty much consistent level of low quality throughout his career.
Yeah.
Whether assisting or just directing.
He's worked with Ryan Murphy, by the looks of it, more than he's worked with Scorsese. Oh my god, that's awful. I checked on, to come back to Colin Trevorrow, I checked before we started. Colin Trevorrow has been handed one of the Star Wars films and the remake of Flight of the Navigator and the Jurassic Park sequel. And this is all based on Jurassic World, but he's done nothing before Jurassic World. He did Safety Not Guaranteed and like a couple of shorts. And like a documentary, and I just don't understand like this whole thing. Like if you want to do like a calling card thing, you want to be an indie film director, you want to do a small indie film just so you can get the bigger Hollywood gigs. I got nothing against that, but it's like how does anyone go, oh, you know, how he's so inexperienced, they hand him this massive film. There's two schools of thought. It's either that they think, the Hollywood producers think, this generation of people like Colin Trevorrow, they all watched Jurassic Park when they were younger and they've got all these new inspired ideas. Or two, they think that, you know, what have they got to lose? Because some big director might go, oh no, I can't handle that. Whereas someone like Trevorrow will go, oh, I'll have a bash there. And then they did a stupid script. It's like two scripts just kind of crashed together. I mean, it wasn't awful. I didn't hate Jurassic World. But I just don't understand how you go from Safety Not Guaranteed to Jurassic World. Like, who thinks that's a good idea?
Money.
If I'd made... Yeah.
Well, yeah, they're not paying much.
It's ridiculous. It drives me crazy.
But then getting Spielberg to do a new one, so I'll just give it to that bloke who had a film at Sundance. And they're doing it again because the Skull Island, which is the new King Kong movie, that's directed by the guy. Oh, is it a duo of people who directed The Kings of Summer?
No, which it's was just a Sundance film John Bond Roberts. He's just got a weird name. I really liked Kings of Summer, so I'm kind of looking forward to it, but at the same time, it is a bit like, yeah, you're kind of repeating the whole Colin Trevorrow thing again.
But there are a lot of examples of, you know, first-time films that are great, but the directors have then gone on to blockbusters and they just haven't managed to capture that same energy. I mean, just look at Fantastic Four, with Josh Trank going from Chronicle to Fantastic Four and just not being able to keep up with the studio's demands and just falling under pressure and having his version of the film being taken away from him because he hasn't got a style distinctive enough to, you know, really sort of, I don't know, collaborate with the studio.
Yeah, the most famous example of it, I guess, would be, what's his name? He's British. They just did the documentary about him. The guy that directed The Island of Dr. Monroe before he was kicked off, Richard...
Oh, not Schlesinger, was it?
Richard Stanley. He was like, he made a couple of indie horror films, and then like he got all this money to make The Island of Dr. Monroe, and he failed so hard and was kicked off. And then that's when they replaced him with John Frankenheimer.
And that's when he didn't he sneak back onto the island and like try and sabotage the filming?
Yeah, not so much sabotage. He went a bit crazy after it all failed, and it was because they're in Australia that he started hanging out with some Aboriginals in a tribe, which was like near the set of the filming. And a couple of, because the filming was so crazy and just like such a mess, a couple of the crew were just walked off and found him and were like, oh my god, it's you. Do you want to come back into the film as like one of the masked guys? So he did. And he's in the film as like one of the monkeys.
That's so random. Yeah. I love stories like that about people like Dennis Hopper and Easy Rider. They were so pissed off with Dennis Hopper, the crew were, by the time they got to New Orleans, they were like, right, we're taking the film hostage until you like come and apologize. And then they went off and enjoyed Mardi Gras, and Dennis Hopper had to come like on bended knee and kind of go, I'm sorry, I'll treat you better. Oh, Dennis Hopper. Oh, what a brilliant man. A crazy, brilliant man.
Good director.
Yeah, I love stories like that about people. I don't know, it's not good to kind of get people to be kind of mad geniuses and that. But some people, they just have these great stories or about things that films go wrong. There was this great, I can't remember his name, there's this cameraman who used to work with Coppola, and he was in a helicopter, I think it was a helicopter, and he had his legs dangling outside the helicopter. Another helicopter went past, and he lost one of his legs. But he continued to be a cameraman, and then a few years later, I think it was on Apocalypse Now, he was in another helicopter, and he fell out of the helicopter and drowned. And it was like, and it's so weird, but it's like he died doing what he loved. I'm not sure how old he was, though. I think he was probably like only early 40s.
Well, there seems to be this trend now where like this whole trend of documentaries about failed films.
Yeah.
It's become like a huge thing now.
They're going to do, I think, oh god, what's the one about Gilliam's Don Quixote? Lost in La Mancha, is it?
Oh, Lost in La Mancha, yeah.
Yeah, and they're going to, I think he's going to try and make it again, and somebody else is like getting the camera ready, like, oh, this could go pear-shaped again.
Again, and there's the one about Superman Lives as well.
Oh yeah, I wanted to see that. That looks like it's going to be, well, interesting, if anything. Have you ever seen Kevin Smith's, On an Evening with Kevin Smith, and he talks about, he wrote a Superman script for someone, I can't remember who it was, some like Hollywood producer or something, and he went round to his house, and the Hollywood producer was like, read me the script, he said, I'm going to picture it on the ceiling, and he just apparently like laid down on a couch, just stared up at the ceiling, and he had this idea about like big spiders. He said, oh, Superman could be facing some kind of giant spider, and he was really addicted to this idea of spiders. Then he made a film a few years later, and that was, like, the enemy, and it was, like, this big fuck-off spider.
Yeah, Wild Wild West.
Yes! Oh, God. Wild Wild West, the memory of that just coming back to me. Oh, what an appalling film.
I know, and it has Kevin Kline in it, so you just feel bad.
Yeah.
And, like, most of my friends know Kevin Kline solely from Wild Wild West.
Oh, no! Yeah. Oh, you should show them. You can show them Fish Called Wanda. There's that really terrible bit in it where it's Kenneth Branagh and Kevin Kline and Will Smith, and they're just trading, like, racist slurs at each other, but because they're both Shakespearean actors, it's supposed to be, like, okay, and it's so appalling.
Yeah, there's this weird film. Bit where, like, yeah, he's just making, like, slave jokes and...
Yeah.
You're, like, you're a cripple and all this, and then, like, his big comeback to Will Smith is, like, he made a giant dildo. Like, it's just such a weird film.
And this is a kid's film as well.
Yeah. It was my favourite film as a kid.
The strangest thing about it.
Yeah. It had a brilliant music video, though, I've got to say. Wild Wild West, the music video. Apparently they spent like a couple of million on the music video, probably because they were so worried the film would do so badly.
Wild Wild West.
When did Wild Wild West come out? It couldn't have been 94.
I thought it was 99.
No, it was late 90s.
I thought it was 99 from memory.
Because I went and saw it when I was, God, it was 99. Jesus, that means I was... Oh, somebody gave us... Look at that, 4.8 on IMDb. I went and saw that in the cinema. Someone gave us some preview tickets down in Swansea for some reason, which is like an hour away. We went down and saw it at like 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. It was so friggin' disappointing. My parents were like, we'll take you to Burger King. Whereas these days, like, I would never drive like an hour to go to a preview screening of such a film. Love Sharknado 2 on a different level.
No. I felt so bad watching the, like, I watched a bit of the first one, and it's got, oh my god, he in the film, he's like a fat, like, drunk guy that is, like, gets crushed by a bus or something. He's like the fat, like, belligerent, but, like, drunk friend, and it's an older guy. Let me look him up. But he was, like, he's in a film called Cutter's Way with Jeff Bridges. He was, give me one second. John Hurd.
Oh, yeah, John Hurd.
John Hurd.
Home Alone and that stupid Goldie Hawn film. Oh, my God, you should see the pictures of Sharknado they put on IMDb. It only gets 3.3 on IMDb, Sharknado.
I'm shocked.
I really want to watch all the
Sharknado films. The problem with the Sharknado films is that each one is more knowing than the last. It's like the first one was just a bad film by accident. Like, they're trying to make a good film, but it just turned shit. And then from there, it's just like, every time, like this is going to be a bad film. We're going to, like, load it with, like, a lot of celebrity cameos and just sort of wink at the audience. And it just makes it sort of less funny each time.
I kind of liked it a bit more, but I think it's going to fall apart at some point. But I really want to watch all the Asylum films or things like, what is there? There's one called Ghost Shark, and there's one. Is it Ghost Shark? And apparently, the shark actually, like, anywhere there's water, the shark comes out of it. And apparently, someone's holding like a bucket of water, and the shark comes out of the bucket of water. I'm not sure if it's Ghost Shark, something like that. Then there's like, I'm not sure if Big Ass Spider is one of Asylum's. Titanic 2. I had the idea for Titanic 2, and it was so totally stolen off me.
Yeah, nah, Big Ass Spider's not Asylum. That's like a legitimate comedy.
Yeah. I'm thinking of, what is it called? Something Spider. Because Big Ass Spider is like a kid's film, isn't it?
There's one called Lavalantula, which has all the cast of Police Academy in it.
My god, I have to see that. Someone's put a review of Sharknado on IMDb, and it's called,
like, Alex Nemo, just called it up, but with all DVDs. Sharks and the webcam cameras while you're listening at home.
Yeah, I've got a pile next to me, so I'm just looking up. You're talking about bad films, reminds me of One Man Force.
I have not seen One Man Force.
No, no one has. But the film opens where he's a cop and he gets into a shootout, and to protect himself, he picks up a fridge and uses it as like a bullet deflector, and everyone shoots into the fridge, and then he walks up to the guy and he slams the fridge between the guy and the pole.
Oh, that looks awesome.
Yeah, One Man Force is awesome.
But if Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull taught us anything, it's that fridges can just withhold anything.
Oh, they're bulletproof and nuclear
holocaust.
Yeah.
Or just fighting bad guys.
Fridges are pretty awesome. Crystal Skull. That was on the other day, and I always try to like it, but it doesn't happen. It's very bothersome. But there's, what was I thinking of? Bad films. Oh, who wrote, Alistair, was it you who wrote the thing about bad films on Film and Career?
Bad films are like, good. Yeah, yeah.
And that. Room was on there as well.
Yeah.
And I saw, and my sister showed me a CinemaSins video for Room, and I'm like, I have to see this film now. Wasn't it like a thing for money laundering? Like, they think the production was for money laundering?
For The Room, yeah. Because every, like, sort of few months, Tommy Wiseau would go back and ask for more money, and it's clearly not there in the finished product yet. I think they cost something like, I may be wrong, but I think it went up to like $12 million, the production.
Blah. Yeah, I really want to see it now. That's the thing, as soon as somebody says a film's really bad or, like, really weird, I'm just like, oh, I have to see that. Yeah, it's all good.
The Room is in the top tier of, like, so bad it's good.
Like, it's not just been something
you cannot watch alone, though. You have to watch it with
friends. You have to watch it with people, but
experience the madness.
It actually does live up to the reputation that, like, it kind of precedes it. Like, it legitimately is a really entertaining hunk of crap.
Oh, excellent. Because I hate it when a film is just bad. You know, someone's like, oh, it's so bad, it's good, and you watch it, and you're like, no, that was just bad.
You get that a lot with comedies. Like, unfunny comedies are, like, the most painful thing to sit through.
Yeah. What was I thinking of? That's what really got me about Pitch Perfect 2. They was like, they could have done so much with it. And they were like, no, we're going to go for the stereotypical jokes. And then Elizabeth Banks directed it so badly, all the comic timing was just, like, sucked out of it. Still quite mad at that film. That's what I do. I never hate films, but I get mad at them for disappointing me. That's what happens.
That's the view I should take. Huh? I feel that's how I'd be. Instead of just hating films, I should just be like, oh, film, just go and sit in the corner and think about what you've done.
I think I almost wrote that at the end of my Trainwreck review, and I was going to write, like, Jen Amy, I'm not mad, just disappointed. Oh, I did that with Trainwreck. I do like Amy Schumer, but Trainwreck was just such a mishmash. And what's really annoying is it's good that you have films you look forward to and they don't kind of pull up as much. Whereas, like, Man Up, I didn't know Man Up was coming out, and I kind of fell in love with Man Up. But it's, it's annoying now because things are going to come out. Like, I've waited a few years for Everest and that looks like it's going to go a bit pear-shaped. And then you've got The Walk, and if you've seen Man on Wire, you kind of know what happens in The Walk anyway.
That's kind of the
funniest thing about The Walk is the fact that the trailer ends with him sort of walking over the Twin Towers, but there's this shot where the wire just wobbles and he's like, oh, is he going to fall? And everybody in the audience is like, well, no, because we've seen Man on Wire. We know he's going to make it. But they're trying to make it. It's like, ooh, does he make it?
Yeah, and so, if there was an incident where a guy fell from the Twin Towers, everyone would know about it. Yeah. That would be like worldwide news.
I'm going to go and see it. I think I'm going to see it in the 3DX Plus now we've got, like, in the local cinema, because I feel like the story's not going to do it for me because I know what happens, but at least I can, like, see it from a spectacle point of view. But
I got the invite for it this morning, so I'm going to go next week.
This come out? Actually, it won't be out here for, like, a couple of weeks, is it?
They're actually embargoed.
October 9th in the UK.
Nice.
Yeah, over here, it's actually embargoed a week after the screening for review.
Oh.
Okay.
Maybe their favourite. I do love Robert Zemeckis, though. Robert Zemeckis is awesome, except for, like, you know, there's some films occasionally, you're like, Robert Zemeckis directed that? Okay, we'll just forget about that.
Well, he had that period.
This whole motion capture stuff is just best ignored. But everything else, fair enough.
He got that real obsession with it. Kind of like a lot of old directors now have these weird obsessions with this technology, like, obviously the worst, like Michael Mann, and his obsession with digital photography.
It's like, it's like they're all like, oh, we want to learn something new. Spielberg even does it a bit. I think Spielberg went a bit, that's why he went a bit crazy with the CGI maybe on Crystal Skull.
And indeed he's on motion capture with Tintin as well, which I actually quite enjoyed. Tintin.
I thought I had memories of Tintin because I had terrible sciatica at the time and I had this huge pain running through my leg. But I got, just before Tintin came out, there's a news reporter, Alice, I'm not sure if you've seen him, he's called Frank Gardner and he works for BBC. And he's paraplegic now because he was shot in the back. Sorry, I'm getting back to Tintin. And he loved Tintin, and when he was growing up, when he was a student, he went on this Trail of Europe, like a European backpacking adventure. And when Tintin came out, they did this documentary on the BBC, and it's Frank revisiting all these places, but like from a wheelchair, and how he experiences it. And it was such a great documentary that when I actually saw the Tintin film, I thought, oh, this is pants. Like, I'd prefer to go and see this Frank Gardner documentary again. Because it was just so good.
I need to see that documentary then. I love revisiting films I used to love and just finding that I hate them now.
It was just so emotional because, of course, Frankie, now he's in a wheelchair and he didn't think he could experience things in the same way. But yeah, I had terrible sciatica when I watched the film, so I completely think. But what I did is I got it on DVD thinking, I'm sure I'll enjoy it more the second time round, and I didn't. Oh, I hate it when they get so distracted by the effects and motion capture. It's like, we'll do away with the story. The story's not important. Whereas Pixar won't, like, move an inch until they've got that story right.
Yeah, Mia Merlin and the Dying Girl is not very good. Trainwreck is meh. And, that's everything. That's what we could learn from this episode.
Is that there's a whole bunch of films we don't like.
Yeah.
Should we recommend films that we do like at the end to sort of give a nice ending to it?
Yeah, films we've seen recently, or what does Alex have there?
I wanted to recommend, because I really, really liked it, A Cult is My Passport.
Cult is My Passport. That sounds familiar.
Directed by Takashi Nomura, and it's very, very similar to Sergeant Suzuki.
I'm trying to think of it. I wouldn't
have seen it. Sorry, I'll go something less obscure.
Yeah. No, I think the more obscure, the better. This needed to be homework.
Well, that's kind of what I try to do on the Facebook page, is trying to go more obscure. Like, not so much the predictable choices on everything.
Film with the... You know, actually, it's a good film. I've been doing this 10 films to kind of make you happy in that. And one film I didn't put on that, it's more of a favourite of mine, is something called Dean Spanley. And it's... If anyone's listening to this, Dean Spanley is a lovely film. It's about, it's got Sam Neill in it, Peter O'Toole, and Jeremy Northam. And it's about a reverend that basically has had a past life as a dog. And it's a really lovely film. They put it on BBC now and then, but I suppose everybody else in the world can get it on DVD.
Peter O'Toole, yeah. If you want to have
a very happy film, that's it, Dean Spanley. Alistair, you got one?
I'm just trying to think of one. Should I do something that I've seen recently, or one that sort of ties in with what we've been talking about today? That's what I'm thinking.
So something like a better version of Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. Krista! You two are wrong. Krista's a brilliant film. Don't listen to them. I'm right. Krista's awesome.
I haven't even seen Twister, I don't think. If I have, I was very, very young and it'll be on like ITV.
You need to see it on Blu-ray. Don't watch it on ITV. Watch it on Blu-ray because the sound is so good on Blu-ray.
It really feels like a Twister's coming towards you. Surround sound and everything.
If you have it like on proper kind of stereo and that, you actually feel like you can hear all the grinding noises and all the layers of sound. It's so cool.
Okay, for my recommendation, this is a difficult one. Instead of me recommending anything, just ask me in person, like, what you think's a good film. If you see me on the street, just ask me what you think, you know, what's a good film. I'll give you a recommendation. Under Pressure, there's no chance. What I watched recently is good. I watched the French 1955 film Diabolique, which is one of the classic films. I saw that for the first time recently.
The horror one, right?
Yeah, and like 60 years after its release, it's still really tense towards the end. Great twists and turns, very exciting filmmaking. I didn't think that a film from the black and white period would still, I don't know, as a modern viewer, would actually still have an effect on me, but it still works wonders. So I'm going to recommend that then. And
No, I've seen it. It is the twist at the end still works really well.
Oh, so there's a twist. Oh no, don't set it up as a twist, because when people tell me there's a twist, I'm like get really excited, and then I'm like, that wasn't much of a twist. Have I seen it though? I might have seen it.
It's a rare case of I knew there was a twist, but it still worked for me.
It's shot really well as well, so.
Yeah.
Same with I'll kind of put this as my recommendation then to kind of go off you, but Witness for the Prosecution, the Billy Wilder film.
Yeah.
That was made in the 50s, and that's one where the twist still works really well.
I haven't been able to get that on DVD. There's a couple of films, and for ages they've been sat on, like, a love film list, which I'm not sure if everybody, where everybody else has in the world. It's like DVD delivery service. And there's some films, they're just not... they're not providing them, and it's so irritating. But a couple of them are appearing on Netflix now, so maybe I can find them on there. But yes, I shall go and check and see if I've seen Death of Wanaki. I'm not sure if I've seen it. Oh, but then again, I could just rent it, maybe try and find some way of renting it and put it on, and just, I'll know in 10 minutes if I've seen it before.
Yeah.
I'm sure it'll make an impact. It would have made an impact, I guess, if I'd seen it before.
Yeah, it definitely would have been an impact. As I said, the final 15 minutes, just excellent. And the rest of the film's pretty good too.
And Occult is my passport, I should remember that.
It's like
I really...
80 minutes, so it's super short.
I shall go and see it now. Well, I don't have to see it now. I got to go to work. It was nice to see you guys. And I shall say goodbye. I'm not sure how to hang it after that.
That's cool. Oh, thanks both for coming.